The Senate will please come back to order. We have messages from the House.
February the 24th, 2015, from the House of Representatives, message number 352, Joint Conference Committee report adopted. Mr. President, House Joint Resolution number 3, Free Roaming Wild Horses. The House adopted the Joint Conference Committee number 1 report on the bill listed above by the vote indicated. Ayes 58, excused 2. Patricia Benskin, House Chief Clerk. February the 24th, 2015, from the House of Representatives, message number 351, concurrence failed. Mr. President, House Bill number 15, Restoration of Voting Rights by Department of Corrections. The House failed to concur on Senate amendments to the bill listed above by the vote indicated. Ayes 2, noes 56, excused 2. House requests the Senate to adopt Conference Committee number 1 to meet with a like committee from the House to report recommended amendments to the bill for final consideration by both houses. Patricia Benskin, House Chief Clerk. Somewhere. It should have a vote on it. Well, there it is. February the 24th, 2015, from the House of Representatives, message number 353, concurrence requested. Mr. President, Senate file number 18, expungement of misdemeanors. The Senate file listed above passed on third reading in an amended form as follows by the vote indicated. Ayes 59, excused 1. The House respectfully asks the Senate to concur by adopting the listed amendments. From the House of Representatives, message number 354, concurrence requested. Mr. President, Senate file 29. Motor vehicle driver's license exemptions. The Senate file listed above passed on third reading in amended form by the vote indicated. Ayes 57, noes 2, excused 1. House respectfully asks Senate to concur by adopting the listed amendments. From the House of Representatives, message number 355, concurrence requested. Mr. President, Senate file 42. Task Force on Mineral Taxes. The Senate file listed above passed on third reading in an amended form as follows by the vote indicated. Ayes 59, excused 1. The House respectfully asks Senate to concur by adopting the listed amendments. From the House of Representatives, message number 359, concurrence requested. Mr. President, Senate File 81, Kevin's Law. Senate file listed above passed on third reading in an amended form as follows by the vote indicated. Ayes 42, noes 18, excused 1. House respectfully asks Senate to concur by adopting the listed amendments. February the 24th, 2015, from the House of Representatives, message number 358, conferees appoint a joint conference committee number 1. Mr. President, the House appointed House conferees to meet with a like committee number 1 from the Senate on amendments to House Bill 154. The House conferees are Representative Kirkbride, Chairman, Representatives Allen and Kasparek. From the House of Representatives, message number 356, third reading passed. Mr. President, the bill listed below passed the House on third reading by a vote indicated. Senate File 62, Oral Chemotherapy Parity, ayes 49, noes 10, excused 1. From the House of Representatives, message number 357, third reading passed. Mr. President, the bill listed below passed the House on third reading by the vote indicated. Senate File 137, Farm License Plates, ayes 57, noes 2, excused 1. Patricia Benskin, House Chief Clerk. February the 24th, 2015, from the House of Representatives, message number 360, third reading failed. Mr. President, the bill listed below failed to pass the House on third reading by the vote indicated. Senate File 103, Bicycle Pathway and Highway Separation, ayes 30, noes 29, excused 1. From the House of Representatives, message number 361, third reading failed. Mr. President, the bill listed below failed to pass the House third reading by the vote indicated. Senate File 106, Powdered Alcohol, ayes 30, noes 21, excused 1. Patricia Benskin, House Chief Clerk. You want any of these back?
We have concurrences. The first concurrence is going to be for Senate File.
I just need
that. Was 12. Let's
see. I just need this.
12, all right. Senator Christensen, are you ready on Senate File 12, trespassing to collect data?
Yes, Mr. President.
If the reading clerk would please read in the message.
February the 23rd, 2015, from House of Representatives, message number 344, concurrence requested. Mr. President, Senate File 12, trespassing to collect data. The Senate file listed above passed on third reading in an amended form as follows by the vote indicated. Ayes 49, noes 10, excused 1. The House respectfully asks Senate to concur by adopting the listed amendments.
Senator Christensen.
Thank you, Mr. President. I move that the Senate do adopt a concurrent... I move that the Senate do concur with House, with message number 344 on Senate File 12, trespassing to collect data, and ask that the Senate vote no. Mr. President, the House offered some very good amendments, but there were a couple of words in a couple of sentences that are worthy of further discussion. With your no vote, we will be able to do that.
Any discussion on the request? The motion is that the Senate do concur on Senate File 12, trespassing on to collect data, and you've been asked to vote no. Will the Chief Clerk please call the roll?
Anderson District 2? Anderson District 28?
No.
Barnard?
No.
Bebout?
No.
Burns?
No.
Case?
No.
Christensen?
No.
Coe?
No.
Cooper?
No.
Kraft?
No.
Dockstetter?
No.
Driscoll? Emmerich?
No.
Escobel?
No.
Geis?
No.
Hastert?
No.
Hicks?
No.
Johnson?
No.
Kinski?
No.
Landon?
No.
Meyer?
No.
Pappas?
No.
Perkins?
No.
Peterson?
No.
Ross?
No.
Rothfuss?
No.
Scott?
No.
Monflatern?
No.
Wasserberger?
No.
President Nicholas?
No.
Closing vote. Closing. Vote closed. 29 no, 1 excused.
By your vote, you have failed to concur with Senate File 12. We have a joint conference committee report on HJ3. Senator Emmerich, are you ready on House Joint Resolution number 3?
Yes, Mr. President.
If the reading clerk would please read in the conference committee report.
Joint Conference Committee Report, House Joint Resolution 3, Free Roaming Wild Horses. Reference Senate Message number 242. Signing for the House, Representative McKim, Hunt, and Lindholm. Signing for the Senate, Senators Emmerich, Dockstader, and Hicks.
Senator Emmerich.
Thank you, Mr. President. I move Joint Conference Committee Report, Free Roaming Wild Horses, HJ03, in reference to Senate Message 242, and I ask you to vote aye. As the great philosopher Harry Callahan once said, what we got here is a failure to communicate. We added a whereas or two, changed a few things about where we are going to send the resolution, and they bought it. So I'm asking you please to vote yes.
Are we feral or not?
Excuse me, Mr. President.
Well, I was wondering if we're feral or not.
We are indeed feral, because we're all descendants of formerly domesticated stock.
Wow, I'm glad I asked. The motion is the Senate do adopt Joint Conference Committee report for HJ003. And you've been asked to vote aye. Any discussion? Roll call.
Anderson District 2?
Aye.
Anderson District 28?
Aye.
Barnard?
Aye.
Bebout?
Aye.
Burns?
Aye.
Case?
Aye.
Christensen?
Aye.
Coe?
Aye.
Cooper?
Aye.
Kraft?
Aye.
Dockstader?
Aye.
Driscoll excused. Emmerich? Escobel, Geis, Hastert, Hicks, Johnson, Kinsky, Landon, Meyer, Pappas, Perkins, Peterson, Ross, Rothfuss, Scott, Von Flatern, Wasserberger, President Nicholas.
Aye.
Closing vote. Closing. Vote closed. 29 aye, 1 excused.
By your vote, you have voted to adopt Joint Conference Committee Report on House Joint Resolution number 3, Free Roaming Wild Horses. We have a appointment to a joint conference committee. This is the conference committee for Senate file number 33, precinct committee persons elections. The conferees are Case, chairman, Hicks, and Pappas. We have reports from standing committees.
Page February the 24th, 2015, Mr. President, your committee number 3, Revenue, to whom was referred House Bill 81, Wyoming Lottery Distributions, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Kinski, Landon, and Peterson. No, Senator Case. Excuse, Senator Driscoll. Senator Peterson, Chairman.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader, we are at that order of business of bills on consideration on general file.
Mr. President, I move the Senate resolve itself in the Committee of the Whole to discuss bills on general file.
You've heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. That motion's been adopted. Senator Anderson, 28.
No.
This morning it was Ross. You must have failed. I think it was Ross this morning. No, he's about, I think it is Ross. Come on up, Tony. Poor Senator Anderson's about ready to.
Okay. Looks good to me. I don't know about you. Oh, and it doesn't say Tony Ross here. It says Phil Nicholas. Me the whole will come to order.
On appropriation.
I have transformed myself into a banty rooster. Okay. First bill for our consideration is House Bill 161. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill number 161, Retirement Account Exemption from Execution, sponsored by Representative Brown. It was referred to Committee number 1, Judiciary. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Christensen, Esquivel, Kinsey, Von Fladern. Excuse, Senator Hicks, Senator Christensen, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What's your pleasure, Senator Christensen?
Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with a favorable recommendation on House Bill 161, Retirement Account Exemption from Execution. There are no standing committee amendments. To further discuss this bill, I would ask you to call on our President Nicholas.
Mr. President.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I'm looking for those in my notes, which I've lost, but I think I could take you through the bill. Folks, what this does is it conforms our exemptions for retirement accounts to the current IRS code to make sure that we expand the exemptions to all of the relevant accounts. And where we found is that the old language, while you may have set up your own individual retirement accounts, they would be exempt, and certain retirement accounts have always been exempt. There became an issue in respect to whether you inherited retirement accounts, whether they were exempt. What this bill does is afford greater exemptions. So a lot of the definitions fell out, and you'll see that they've gone back to just adopt the IRS code so that anything that's a qualified IRS code becomes exempt. Now, in order to protect creditors, there is a provision that the exemption does not apply if you've taken your retirement account and or put money in the last 90 days. That mirrors the look-back period for bankruptcy code, so you can't just take all your assets, fund them into a retirement account, and then try to abandon your obligations to your creditors. But historically, we have allowed the exemptions from execution by creditors on retirement accounts, and this does expand it to the IRS definitions. And in fact, you can, for example, if a spouse or child inherits your retirement account, as long as the account is set up until the funds are actually withdrawn, they remain protected from creditors, which the bottom line is we expand the protection to all retirement accounts, regardless how they're created and how they're received, but make sure that there's protection to creditors, that you don't try to avoid something as a fraudulent conveyance by conveying it in and then declaring bankruptcy in the next 90 days. With that explanation, Mr. Chairman, I'll stand for questions.
Any questions? Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, I certainly support the purpose of this bill, but I think we better be pretty careful in this area. And the reason I say that is there's some history here. We passed, it was a number of years ago, might even been 20 years ago, a general exemption in this area for retirement accounts. I think it may have even been my bill. And then the Supreme Court came along and we had kind of a squirrely decision where they said a Roth IRA didn't count for the protection because it wasn't specifically named. And I hope I'm capturing the essence of that case. And where we're repealing in this bill some of those specifics we put in there to deal with that particular case so they couldn't hold that way again, I wonder if we're in the process creating some risks they'll go back to that kind of a thing and not honor this particular piece of legislation. The past behavior of our courts in this area make me nervous, and I would appreciate little discussion on that point and whether we need to go name everything. What do we need to do to get the courts to comply with this?
Discussion. Senator Perkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. With respect to that, in fact, that Mr. Chairman, I'll also give my good fellow tall senator from Natrona County kudos. And a couple years ago, there was another bill that came through, and I think there had been some problem in that decision. And so ultimately, you had these exemptions that protected retirement funds, and IRAs had been carved out of that by the Supreme Court. And a couple years ago, my good friend took an example, and we took a bill and threw that in and corrected that. That was just 2 or 3, 4 years ago, if I remember right. What the evil that this, if you call it an evil, but the issue that this bill is trying to address is there's a couple years ago, recently, probably within the last 2 years, there's been a case that came out, and an inherited IRA was deemed to be not covered within the exemption. And that wasn't, I don't think that was our Supreme Court, that was a federal court, or might even have been a bankruptcy court. That's what I believe it was. And so what an inherited IRA is, one that it's not your spouse, it's not yours, but it's like if you left it to your children. And so they looked at that and said ultimately, well, that's, we don't know that that's exemptions is covered. And so ultimately they glommed onto that, and that went to the creditors. And so what this bill in particular does is try and expand that back to where it pulls that, and it's going to make it, it's not going to distinguish between an inherited IRA and your own IRA, and expand that. So if we can tighten up that language, if there's concerns about it, we can look at that and tighten it up. But ultimately, this bill probably expands and continues down that line of protection as opposed to pulling it back. The intent is not to open that door and to reduce the exemption, but to expand it and make it clear that it applies not only to your IRA, whether you're getting it, whether your spouse is getting it, whether your kids or grandkids are getting it.
Further discussion? Senator Scott?
Mr. President, and I certainly support that. What I'm really trying to do by raising a question of this is catch the attention of particularly the attorneys in the body, Mr. Chairman, to make sure that we get this as tight as we can so that our courts, given their history, don't have an opening to go in and say, no, You repealed the specific protection, and it therefore no longer has it, and throw out what we intend. Their history in this area makes me very nervous.
Senator Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I'm just reading back to a case called N. Ray Honeycutt, where the court wrote the following. This is just a summary. So to be exempt from execution, attachment, garnishment, and other legal process, an individual retirement account must be paid or payable by private corporation or employer to employee or retired employee upon the plan. It went on to say the debts privately established or debtors privately established and funded individual retirement account was not exempt from the state exemption statute, which I assume is either the same case that was referred to by our colleague or separately. As I read the case very quickly, and we will study that more carefully, but as I look at it, is that the way the exemption statute was drafted at the time is that these exemptions are narrowly construed to protect creditors, essentially following debt. I believe the intent of this language, or I know the intent is, I believe the question is, did they accomplish it? This account, this language expands the coverage and makes it much more liberal to the retiree, if you will. And we have two areas to be really focused on. I think one is lines 16 through 18 on page 6. That's where now what we're doing is defining plans that are qualified as an annuity. And we adopt by reference the references to all of the IRS codes, which should pick up most of your retirement accounts. And then over on page 5, you'll notice that we have the issue of beneficiary, includes persons, trusts, trustees, including those who inherit and who get it directly and indirectly, so that in many instances it's true that you set up accounts and they're held in the name of trustees on your behalf, or you have a retirement account. My employees, for example, there, and it's probably true for other companies, their retirement accounts are actually held by the employer on trust for the retiree employees. So I think it does cover that. We will double check to make sure that, email that to our colleague and make sure that's the case that he had in mind and make sure that we're protecting these accounts.
Senator Scott.
Chairman, yes, my memory is that it was the Honeycutt case that caused the trouble before. And I think we just need to be extra careful in this area because the courts have shown some tendency to misconstrue what we do in this particular area.
Further discussion? You ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Christian's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rise to report to do so with a favorable recommendation on House Bill 161, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? 161. House Bill 161 has passed Committee of the Whole. Next bill for our consideration is House Bill 160. The reading clerk will read it.
House Bill number 160, Special Warranty Deed, sponsored by Representative Brown. It was referred to Committee Number 1, Judiciary. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Christensen, Escobel, Kinski, Von Fladeren, excuse Senator Hicks, Senator Christensen, Chairman.
Heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Senator Christensen?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with a favorable recommendation on House Bill 160, Special Warranty Deeds. There are no standing in committee amendments. To further discuss the bill, I would ask you to call on Senator Perkins.
Vice President.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I bring you this good little House bill that I signed on. What we're doing here is, Mr. Chairman, in Wyoming, you have the choice in deeds between a warranty deed and a quitclaim deed. What we bring to you today is an opportunity for a third, a kind of a subset of a warranty deed called a special warranty deed. These are used in several surrounding states, particularly the one to the south. I use these special warranty deeds. The difference between a special warranty deed and a general warranty deed is in a general warranty deed, you're warranting the title of not only what you've owned, but everybody that owned it before you. And so you have to, when you provide the title insurance and you make that warranty to the person who buys that property from you, you're warranting not only that you have the right to sell it, and it's your, but your everything back down the line before it even came into your ownership. What the special warranty deed does is it's your warranting that while you've had the property and while you own the property, you're warranting that you haven't done anything to encumber this property any more than since it came into your possession. And so what this does is has the ability to provide an opportunity for you not to have to, as you sell that property, to make sure that it's you're warranting what you know that you can warrant. Title companies have insured these in all of our surrounding states. I haven't heard anything particularly negative with respect of title companies in this state and how they would deal with that. They deal with it many other places in the country. And that's the purpose of this little bill. It provides an opportunity for as an alternative to a general warranty deed, provide this special warranty deed with a more restricted warranty. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd stand for questions.
Any questions? You ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Christensen's motion that when the committee of the whole rise reported, do so with a due pass recommendation on House Bill 160, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? House Bill 160 is passed. Committee of the whole. Next bill for our consideration is House Bill 186. The reading clerk will read it.
House Bill number 186, Human Trafficking Forfeiture of Property. Sponsored by Representative Conley. It was referred to Committee Number 1 Judiciary. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Christensen, Escobel, Hicks, Kinski, Von Flavin, Senator Christensen, Chairman.
For the reading of the bill, what's your pleasure, Senator Christensen?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with a favorable recommendation on House Bill 186, Human Trafficking Forfeiture of Property. There are no standing committee amendments. To further discuss the bill, I would ask you to call on Senator Rothfuss.
Mr. Minority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I bring House Bill 186, Human Trafficking Forfeiture of Property. Mr. Chairman, this is a piece of legislation that follows on the human trafficking article that was created 2 years ago. Ran through the legislature, and at that time when it was drafted, there was originally legislation in it that would provide for asset forfeiture, but based on the fact that the Judiciary Committee was going to do interim work on asset forfeiture specifically, the thought at the time was that we would wait as a body until that work was done and then incorporate the updated asset forfeiture provisions once the work was finished on the asset forfeiture related to drugs and drug seizures. So this is the follow-on to that. And effectively, Mr. Chairman, it is the legislation that we've already taken a look at with regard to asset forfeiture for drug seizures and asset forfeiture incidents, but incorporated now as a portion of our Article 7 in the human trafficking forfeiture of property. Mr. Chairman, while we've had some concern and some discussion about the civil asset forfeiture with regard to drug offenses and criminal offenses already in statute, I would let the body know that this does not have the same concerns, because a lot of those concerns are due to provisions whereby there wouldn't be any asset forfeiture taking place if there was an incident that resulted only in a misdemeanor conviction rather than a felony conviction. In this article, there are no misdemeanor convictions. All of them are felony convictions. So you see, as we go through this particular piece of legislation, it actually takes care of that problem that some have had and applies correctly as it needs to. So what we've seen, Mr. Chairman, over the last few years is since 2013, when this human trafficking has gone into effect, there have been 37 calls based on human trafficking concerns, and 6 victims in 2013 and 2 in 2014 that had been reported. So we've seen use already in the last 2 years, of that new article and the new protections under statute. However, there has not and is not anything under statute right now that allows for asset forfeiture under circumstances where there are crimes related to human trafficking. We have them, obviously, when it comes to drug crimes, and if there's drug-related materials, those could potentially be seized. But there is no possibility under current Wyoming law for asset forfeiture under statutes where the convictions are being made with regard to human trafficking. That might be child labor, that might be sex trafficking, but there's no provisions right now, and this would add them then for the first time under statute. As we look through the bill, Mr. Chairman, you see it begins the creation then of 62711, which is the asset forfeiture provision that goes into Article 7 of human trafficking within the Title 6 crimes and offenses. On to page 2, this follows the same language and conforms with the language that we previously worked on drug-related asset forfeiture. You see that here are the following subjects for when forfeiture could take place. The assets are subject to jurisdiction on lines 5 and 6 for circumstances where crimes within this article are violated. You see moving through that this is related to human trafficking, trafficking of individuals, related to materials that are acquired by or maintained or derived from those types of crimes. On to page 3. One of the things that you will see throughout this provision, and it's repeated over and over again, you'll see for the first time in Romanet 3 on page 3, is, for example, under circumstances where a conveyance, such as an aircraft, vehicle, or vessel is seized, there has to be evidence or clear evidence, clear indication that it is knowingly used or intended for use to transport those victims. So throughout this, if there is an asset forfeiture, that forfeiture takes place under circumstances where it is being knowingly used for that crime. Again, that will be repeated over and over again, Mr. Chairman, to ensure that there are not any incorrect asset forfeitures that are not related directly to the crime and knowingly related to the crime. You see moving on that we've got further determinations on conveyances in A, B, and C at the bottom of page 3, indicating the necessity for knowledgeable and exceptions for circumstances where there is not knowledge available. Same thing on page 4. We move on to other seizable or forfeitable assets, including buildings, any other property. If those properties are encumbered by a bona fide security interest or any other lien on them, then those would be obviously taken care of, presupposing the asset forfeiture. So the entity that had a lien or a financial interest would be made whole, as well as on page 5 that goes on to oversee assets being exposable. You see in the B section on page 5 the instances where property subject to forfeiture under this article may be seized by any law enforcement officer. And then under most circumstances, it has to be upon process issued by a district or circuit court, but there are certain exceptions where seizure without process may be made if, and then you can see that it's incident to an arrest or under circumstances where there's a prior judgment in favor. The bottom of page 5, a key provision here is that any person convicted of a violation of this article which is punishable by imprisonment for more than 1 year shall be subject to the possibility of forfeiture of property. Again, this goes back to circumstances where it's all felony convictions. You would have to have a felony conviction to be eligible for asset forfeiture under this article, but that's acceptable certainly because there are no non-felony provisions within this article. So everything in the article is covered effectively, and there are none of the concerns that were previously voiced in the drug crime asset forfeiture with relation to misdemeanor forfeiture possibilities. On page 6 in D, it goes on to discuss the conditions and the circumstances under which the state seeks to forfeit property. And first and foremost is an indictment or information shall contain notice to the defendant that identifies the property. All property shall be returned unless there is a finding or verdict of guilt, an admission of guilt, or a plea of nolo contendere to a felony under this act. After a verdict, the court shall conduct a forfeiture hearing. On page 7, it indicates that the court may include additional conditions that are reasonably necessary to preserve the property's value pending any appeal. Moving on to page 7, there are additional considerations, and then on Romanet 1, under the circumstance that there might be an external interest, there's publication of notice for the order. Page 8, possibility of a third-party timely response, as well as a defendant appeal at the bottom and the circumstances that would govern there. On page 9, going on to an interest in property belonging to a third party and how to handle that in Romanettes 1, 2, and 3 on the next page. Again, those conform with the previous legislation that we've seen and already discussed. On page 10, additional circumstances and discussion about property taken or detained under this section shall not be subject to replevin. On H at the bottom, within 6 months after the final order of forfeiture, the asset shall be liquidated and sold with the prioritization of the fund distribution in accordance with Romanettes 1 through 5, where it begins with court-ordered restitution, civil judgments entered against the forfeiting defendant, costs of storing and maintaining the forfeited property, costs of forfeiture proceedings, and finally, any excess funds will go to crime victims compensation account as created by statute 140-114. Mr. Chairman, that's the legislation. This is something that already exists in 33 states. We haven't had it yet, again, because we made that choice consciously 2 years ago in recognizing that we were going to need to upgrade our statutes. This conforms with those upgraded statutes as laid out by the Judiciary Committee during their interim work, and I'd urge the body to support it. Be happy to answer any questions that the body has.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm wondering, and I was trying to figure out in here about the actual ownership when you go through the forfeiture. It talks about the use of certain things, aircraft, vessels. You even got a building, but then it says if the owner has knowledge of or gives consent to. How do you really to differentiate between an innocent owner that you might rent an aircraft or whatever the case might be that's used for it, and how is it protected in this forfeiture? It seems to me that whatever is involved, and when they see it, they can go after it, and I don't think that's what is intended here, but I can't find where there's some protection for those innocent owners.
Senator Von Fladen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I can answer at least that question. On page 3, line 6, everything is based on knowingly used. So if you look on there, and so if you're the hotel or owner or the plane owner or the truck owner, if you knowingly allowed them to use it, then it could be part of this forfeiture, but otherwise not.
Mr. Jordy Fuller.
Yeah, but Mr. Chairman, that's exactly the point. I mean, who's determining the knowingly used when it's my truck or my vessel or whatever, and then they're going to make that determination and they're going to try to forfeit on mine that I did not knowingly do? That's the problem I have and the level of proof in that. As an owner, then they shouldn't be able to go after my stuff based on a knowingly determination they make on the people that are using it when it's mine independently of theirs.
Senator Rothfuss.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, there are further provisions. If you look at the bottom of page 6, Romanette I, indicating that after a verdict or finding of guilty or after a plea of guilty or nolo contendere is accepted, the court shall conduct a forfeiture hearing to determine if the property is subject to forfeiture under this section. So the court then will have the authorization to do so. You can see also under circumstances on page 7E and beyond, this is a discussion if you the knowingly aspect where it gives additional protections where you're able to enter a third-party interest, which again has court adjudication to protect you. So there are several different layers of protection if you are an innocent owner where the courts have the authority. If you're not convicted of a felony and you're the owner, there are a lot of protections whereby this can make sure that you're made whole and continue to be made whole in the same manner as the other legislation that we put forward. So very good protections are in place in this, and you've got several layers of adjudication backing.
Jordy Fuller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I understand that, and that is some protection. But what about a situation where if it was a rental truck that belongs to one of the large rental companies and somebody came in and rented it, then do they take possession of that at the time they determine it's happened and then go through a forfeiture? And is that locked up until at such time that I go to court and later on I'm able to get it back? How would that be handled?
Minority Floor Leader.
Mr. Chairman, if it was evidence, it would be locked up for a while it's evidence. There's no question about that. That would be under current practice. But since the interest, the stake in it, you can see if there's liens or ownership interest, that's under the same provision, I think it's E or F in the legislation. The owner is going to end up getting it back. There's no way there could be an asset forfeiture under this legislation because that owner is not being convicted. So while it's evidence, it would still be locked up. Once it's no longer evidence, there would be no forfeiture taking place because there would be no ownership, and that's pretty clear in this legislation. So again, nothing would change as I see it under current statute versus with this in place, because it would not be a forfeiture instance. It would simply be an evidence instance.
Okay, further discussion. Senator Bebout.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, the last thing then, under the knowingly provision, are you opening it up so the owner can be included in the violation, or are they going after the people for the trafficking because you now are bringing their equipment in as knowingly, and then you could also say they're involved in it? I just want to be sure we're protecting the innocent owners.
Further discussion?
Let me, Mr. Chairman, let me say that another way. What I want to be sure of, if I have a rental company, I rent a truck, but since the word knowingly is involved in that, and they could suspect that maybe I've been renting trucks to these kind of people before, is there going to be a higher level of reason for them to come after me as knowingly given that truck to that person to conduct this illegal operation?
Mr. Chairman, I believe what we need to do is make sure that the owner of the property is knowingly involved in the illegal enterprise. So it wouldn't be good enough, for example, if your neighbor comes or some, your son or daughter, friend, cousin, come and borrow your vehicle unless you knowingly are involved in the enterprise. And it seems to me that we can provide that level of protection. When I see this, the bill does appear to be drafted on the assumption that once almost a presumption that if the property is used in the enterprise and that the property was knowingly involved in the enterprise, whoever used it, but that doesn't connect it to the owner's knowing involvement in the enterprise. I think that deserves some attention.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, a question along a different line. My question relates to page 11, lines 20 through 21 on the disposition of the forfeiture, which sends any remainder to the crime victim's compensation account. And what I don't understand is, given Article 7, Section 5, which provides that all fines and penalties under the general laws of the state belong to the public school fund of the respective counties, how that provision is consistent with the constitutional provision here. And it would seem to me that we need to change this particular provision to conform to the Constitution.
Minority Floor Leader.
Mr. Chairman, last question first. My good friend from Natrona County, my understanding is that this would not qualify as a fine, and that's why it works. And currently, civil asset forfeiture does not go to the education accounts. It goes and is typically distributed to law enforcement agencies. So we certainly have under current operations that it's not going to education, and my presumption is because, again, it's not a fine. If it turns out that activity is unconstitutional and we have to send all of this to education, I'm usually okay with such things. So if the good senator is correct and we have to hand this over to education, I'll probably go along with it. But that's my understanding of it is that it wouldn't qualify as a fine under the interpretation. With regard to the majority floor leader, the structure of the discussion, again, beginning on page 7, little e, the paragraphs discussing the innocent owners and interests in property stakes, this goes on to F as well on page 9, an interest in property belonging to a third party shall not be forfeited to the extent that the third party establishes it has a perfected lien in the property or proves by a preponderance of evidence that he has a perfected security interest in the property or he proves he is an innocent owner and that it discusses innocent owner. Mr. Chairman, if there are any concerns and if this language isn't tight enough, we can certainly look back at it. But my understanding is that there's an awful lot of coverage for the innocent owner of the goods to not be forfeiting it, and that if you don't have an ownership stake, you are not subject to civil asset forfeiture under these conditions if you haven't been convicted of a felony. In other words, to lose your stuff, you have to be convicted of a felony. And if there is no link back to you as the owner of that rental truck to get you convicted of a felony, you're not going to forfeit your assets. Again, it might go up for evidence for a period of time, but if you're not convicted of a felony, your stuff will not be forfeited under this legislation.
Any further discussion? Hearing none. Are you ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Christensen's motion that when the committee will rise to report, they do so with the due pass recommendation, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? House Bill 186 is passed Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 181. The reading clerk will read it in.
House Bill number 181, speeding penalties in 80-mile-per-hour zone, sponsored by Representative Harshman. It was referred to Committee number 8, Transportation Highway Military Affairs. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Anderson, 02, Emmerich, Escobel, Meyer, no, Senator Johnson, Senator Meyer, Chairman.
Heard the reading of the bill. What's your pleasure? Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move the committee whole rise and report to do so with a favorable recommendation on House Bill 181 do pass, and I'll yield to myself to explain the bill.
Good.
Mr. Chairman, first of all, I am not that colleague of ours from Park County that usually has his name on these bills. But this is a good little bill, and what it does, and I'll go through the reasoning behind it, then explain the bill, Mr. Chairman. We had what we call the Superintendent Speed Zone Bill, I believe, a year ago. And I had a handout that I shared with all of the members of the Senate. And I don't know if you have that in front of you or not, but what it does, it changes from the superintendent speed zone to the standard highway limit. And here's why the bill is necessary, Mr. Chairman. Currently, in the 80-mile-per-hour superintendent zone, the following fines apply. If you're 5 miles per hour over the limit, 85, it's a $55 fine. 6 mile over, it's 70, and trucks, 370. And 15 mile per hour over it, or going 95, it's 120. The proposed bill in front of you, if you're in the 65 to 70, now 80, standard highway limit, the following fines would apply. If you're 5 mile per hour over the limit, it's $25 instead of $55. And if you're 6 mile, it's $95 instead of $70. So it goes up if you're over the 6 mile. Trucks go up to $395. And then if you're 15 miles per hour over it, which is under the $95, it's $160, which is more. Mr. Chairman, if you look at the bill, and I'll go through it specifically, if you look at 315301B, what we do there, we create paragraph 6 to clarify that maximum speed limit on interstate highways designated by the superintendent is 80. 315-1201D1I, the amendment goes from 81 through 85 miles per hour in an 80-mile-per-hour zone. 315-1201D3I, above 80 miles per hour in a 70 mile per hour zone. The amendment shows it above 85 miles per hour in an 80 miles per hour zone. 315-1210DV, there's an amendment there that says the 80 mile per hour zone, including the 65 to 55 and the 75. 315-1201G, this is for vehicles over 26,000 pounds. The amendment says 80 miles per hour zone. 3118-7704, vehicles over 26,000 pounds, fine $100 for. There we say, again, exceeding 85 in an 80-mile-per-hour speed zone. The statutes that we did out amend are 314-103B, which requires drivers to produce evidence of liability, coverage for a moving violation. We did not change 315-301D, which is less than the 6-mile-per-hour over posted speed limit in all other instances, and that would be on your WIO.dot abstracts. And 3115-1201D4, that less than 6 miles per hour posted speed limit in all other instances is not considered for your driver's license suspensions. And then the last one, Mr. Chairman, 315-1202E, the seatbelt fine for all citations for violation of the motor vehicle laws in the state. That stays in effect. I'll be glad to answer any questions.
Any discussion? You ready for the question?
Question.
All those in favor of Senator Bebout's motion that when the committee hold rise report to do so with a due pass recommendation on House Bill 181, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? House Bill 181 has passed Committee of the Whole. Next bill for our consideration is House Bill 76. The reading clerk will read it.
House Bill Number 76, Public Library Endowment Challenge Program Amendments, sponsored by Representative Stubson. It was referred to Committee Number 1, Judiciary. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Christensen, Escobel, Hicks, Kinski, Von Flader, and Senator Christensen, Chairman.
Heard the reading of the bill. What's your pleasure, Senator Christensen?
Mr. Chairman, we're on House Bill 76?
Correct.
Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with a favorable recommendation on House Bill 76, Public Library Endowment Challenge Program Amendments. There are no standing committee amendments to further discuss the bill. I would ask that you call on Senator Burns.
Senator Burns.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, back about 15 years ago, the legislature set up an endowment fund for the community colleges around the state, and as well as the university. And then in 2008, we did a similar thing for the public libraries. The only difference between the two is that in the case of the libraries, depending on the size of the county they were in, we set up, in some cases, a 1-to-1 match, 2-to-1 match, and 3-to-1 match, depending on the size of the libraries. Then in right around that same time, I think it was 2010, with the community colleges, some had met their entire match up to 100%. Others hadn't even come close. So we put an amendment in there stating that they could, one college which had met its 100% of match could go to another college which hadn't and come up with an agreement with them to raise money that they could then use their match on. So, for instance, and there is a handout that illustrates this. So if College A, which has already met its match, goes to College B and says, we'll get a $50,000 match, College B will get half of the money that they were entitled to in the first place without having to raise any dollars themselves. And, Mr. Chairman, what this bill does is extends that same mechanism to the county libraries. If you look at the bill itself, start with page 2. The first thing it does is extend the time for this endowment challenge out from 2017 to 2022 and 2023. There is on page 3, there is a report required on 2024, and then the money then comes back to the general fund. And on page 4, this is the mechanism that we're talking about. Right now, Mr. Chairman, the 3-to-1 match counties are Albany, Bighorn, Crook, Goshen, Hot Springs, Niobrara, Platte, Weston, and Washakie. The 2-to-1 match counties are Carbon, Converse, Johnson, Laramie, Lincoln, Park, Sheridan, and Uinta. The 1-to-1 match counties are Campbell, Fremont, Natrona, Sublette, Sweetwater, and Teton. And 8 counties have come very close to meeting their match within over 90%. Albany, Niobrara, Sheridan, Crook, Natrona, Teton, Carbon, and Park. But a number of the other counties are having a hard time coming close to 100% of their match. So, for instance, surprisingly enough, Campbell County is only 51%, and Sublette's only 72%. Some of the ones are a little more understandable. Bighorn County, for instance, is only 51%. Sweetwater's 38%. So what this allows is, and really surprisingly, Niobrara is 100%. They've met their match. So Niobrara can go to a fellow county and come up with an agreement with their library. So if they have a donor that comes up and says, I'll give you $100,000, and let's say it's a two-for-one match, they give the $100,000 to Niobrara. It goes to where the donor wanted in the first place, but they can split the match that comes from the state, that portion that comes from the state. So as you see in the illustration, if you've got a library that's one-for-one, that's maxed out, they can go to another library that has, let's say, $150,000 left and has a 3-to-1 match. They enter an agreement. The donor gives the first library $50,000. They can split $75,000. They can split $150,000. They get $75,000 each. So that county that wasn't able to raise any additional money gets $75,000 basically for using its credit toward the endowment fund. Mr. Chairman, I would gladly stand for any questions if anybody needs any further explanation of the bill.
Mr. President.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I guess two concerns I have. One is that if we use the analogy that the community colleges, with the community colleges, when we did the, let's call it the endowment swaps, so you could, and what we were really focused is there were some smaller community college districts that simply didn't have the families or people that were likely to be beneficiaries with a great deal of wealth. And all the community colleges don't stand equal. Some are from counties with lower assessment than others. So what we were trying to do is endow the, or enable, if you will, the less fortunate community colleges to attract funds from the more heavily endowed ones. But if all of a sudden now we're saying we take the swap program, we move it to the counties, and you're saying, well, let's create this mechanism, but what we're trying to do is all of a sudden go to a Campbell that's, or a Campbell, but a county that might be called Campbell, just hypothetically. But if you have a county that's has a lot of resources, and the reason they're not attracting donors is because their assessed valuation is so high that donors don't feel that they really need to donate to that facility because they got lots of resources. We're not using the swap for the right purpose. I mean, you can community colleges were different. Now what you're saying, if you have counties that would really want to build up their library funds and they don't have the donors and they're going to counties that are much larger where there are more resources and you're attracting them from essentially the wealthy to the poor, that's a good idea. But it doesn't make any sense to say let's reverse it because folks up in Campbell County are unwilling to give and match their donors will reverse it. So we ought to talk about that. The other issue that we do need to talk about, and it actually involves the community colleges too, we have to always remember, and when we set up these accounts, I'm not sure that we gave them the scrutiny that they need, but in our Constitution, Article 3, Section 36, we say that no appropriation shall be made for charitable, industrial, education, or benevolent purposes to any person, corporation, or community not under the absolute control of the state or to any denomination or sectarian institution association. So we have to, I don't know that we've attended to these, but if you have a 501c3 corporation that's a private charitable that is the auxiliary support for the library endowment, if all the members of it are appointed by your county commissioners or your library board and they're controlled by the state, then that's probably an okay match. But if you have an endowment that is private in nature, notwithstanding it's not profit, and it is not controlled by the entity, and this, by the way, is true for the university as well as the community colleges, those are not appropriate appropriations to do the match. Now, you recall last year we went through and unraveled with respect to the university to make sure that it was always understood that our state dollars are always state dollars.
They never get transferred to a private entity. And I guess the one question is that been considered with respect to this? And do we need to look into that? And then the second question is, are we really creating an incentive that doesn't really benefit a community that's not finding donors on account of the lack of resources?
Senator Burns.
Mr. Chairman, I'm addressing two points that the President made. The last one has to do with the state control of the dollars, and that's actually a good question, and it's a question that we should have asked back in 2008 when we were setting this up, and the question actually didn't come up till last year with the University Foundation, and it's actually a question I brought up at lunchtime in the Appropriations Committee with the community colleges. Do those community colleges that have foundations and money going to it, do we have a similar agreement with them? I believe that that same agreement can be made with these libraries. I don't know how many of them have Friends of the Library foundations or if it's a direct foundation by the library. I assume it's similar to the community colleges in that it's a mixed bag, some of this and some of that. As to the idea of helping out the richer counties, I don't think that that's necessarily what's going to happen. I think it's those counties that make the agreements, I think, will probably be with the poorer counties, frankly, because it's the poorer counties that are smaller, and the smaller counties are the ones that have the better match, the 2-to-1 and the 3-to-1 matches. Nobody's going to want to go, frankly, to, and I don't want to pick on Campbell County anymore, but I will. They have a 1-to-1 match. So why would anybody go to them when they can go to Washakie or Bighorn and get a 3-to-1 match on the same money that they're raising? And I don't think anybody can tell us that either Washakie or Bighorn aren't needy. They aren't in need. We have a number of counties that are in great, especially their libraries, are in great need. One thing I didn't mention in my explanation of the bill, there has been $18.35 million of this endowment fund allocated, and there's about $5 million left. So we're not talking, frankly, in the term of things, comparatively a great deal of money. What we want to do is get the rest of these endowment funds put out there, and it's been 7 years. So frankly, a lot of the fundraising that has been done because of this has reached its saturation point, especially in the counties that have gotten 100% back.
Further discussion. Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Back in the late 70s and the early 80s, when I was state librarian, I set up 501c3 foundations at 21 of the 23 county library systems. And we all did it with what we call interlocking directorates. The foundation board and the library board were the same people, and when somebody went off the library board, they also went off the foundation board, and whoever the commissioners appointed went back onto the library and foundation board. Now, Mr. Chairman, I have no idea how many, first of all, still exist. They kept their reports up in the Secretary of State's office. And I've heard that some of them, to their mutual, they didn't like it later, separated the foundations out with their own board of directors. There the problem is the foundation seems to all of a sudden go on their merry own way, and they don't pay attention to what the library or the library board wants. They think that their decisions are better. So I don't know, Mr. Chairman, how many still have the interlocking directorates, how many still have their foundations, but I bet that the state library can find that out pretty quick, and I'll call and see if I can get that information for them.
Any further discussion? Senator Bebout.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The question I would have, and what we're really trying to do, is to try to help these underperforming areas that are having difficulty in raising the money in some ways, but yet I'm trying to get to, is there a better way to get them? Because the way I understand a lot of these smaller libraries, they need the money, but they just can't get the people to match, and even with the 3-to-1 ratios. And now what you're going to do is those that have already done it, they're going to be able to go to others that can't, like some of these smallers, and say, well, let us use your funds because we can do it. And I wonder about the smaller ones that just can't seem to get enough money, even regardless of the benefits we give to them to help them out. And they're the ones that, at least from what I've heard, have the really need.
Any further discussion? Hearing none, are you ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Christensen's motion, when the Committee of the Whole rise reported to, so with a due pass recommendation, on House Bill 76, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? House Bill 76 has passed Committee of the Whole. Next bill for our consideration is House Bill 120. The reading clerk will read it in.
House Bill number 120, Tribal License Plate, sponsored by Representative Allen. It was referred to Committee number 8, Transportation, Highways, Military Affairs. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Anderson, 02, Emmerich, Escobel, Johnson, and Meyer. Senator Meyer, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Senator Meyer?
Mr. Chairman, that was 76.
No, House Bill 120.
Oh, 120?
They already passed.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rise and report it do so with a due pass motion on House Bill 120. And as soon as a
tribal license plate.
Driver's license plate.
Tribal.
Oh, tribal. And we'll go to the good senator from Fremont County.
God, I don't know how I missed that one. Wait, I need my mitt.
All right.
Okay. Senator Case.
Thank you. Pulled that one out, Mr. Chairman. At least I hope I have. Mr. Chairman, this creates two new kinds of special license plates. It's for the citizens of Wyoming that happen to be members of the Shoshone, the Northern Arapaho tribe and the Eastern Shoshone tribes. They're two separate designs, potentially, and they would be selected in conjunction with the Department of Transportation and the governing bodies of those two tribes. The tribal members would pay the additional $30, which is required to have these specialty plates. The bill, I think, has a minimum of 500 plates for each. And, Mr. Chairman, folks back home want this. They are citizens of Wyoming. They cover the cost of providing these specialty plates. And the bucking horse will remain. The emblem will go next to it like many of our other plates. Be happy to answer any questions.
Questions? Senator Ron Flader.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The question is, I wasn't sure where it said they'd pay for the plates, and my understanding of the the reimbursement we give to the tribe or to the county, they only pay for the actual cost of the plate and no property tax associated. I'm never in favor of more plates for Wyoming, and this is one of them, but I don't see in the bill where they actually pay for it other than the 500 minimum.
Further discussion? Senator Landon.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Just a quick question, having served on that committee, and I should remember, but I don't. I'm just curious how many specialty plates we have now. It's getting to be quite a few. I thought, though, that it was restricted to military and veterans, and I'm sitting here and I can't remember beyond that how many special plates we have. So if somebody knows that, maybe we can learn about that. Thank you.
Senator Case?
Mr. Chairman, I don't know how many plates there are, but it was presented in testimony in committee, and I can't tell you. I think it was a number of like 13 or so, but I'm pulling that out of the air, to be perfectly honest. But it's, Mr. Chairman, they do pay the fee. If you look on page 3, lines 15 and 16, starts on line 14, says application form shall be available at all county treasurer's office. The fee required under WS 31-3-102A Romanet 8 shall accompany each application. That is the additional $30, Mr. Chairman. And then they're required to be enrolled members of the two tribes, and that's the bill, Mr. Chairman. Now, you know, here's the way I look at it. I don't know. I used to be against specialty license plates, but that horse left that barn long, long time ago, and there is no reason to arbitrarily stop that now when these folks are willing to pay the extra fees involved, and you've just begun to see specialty license plates. But, Mr. Chairman, the state gets compensated for these. They get the additional $30 fee, which, that actually makes a bit of a kind of a profit. Now, this is not a plate like the plate for the University of Wyoming, where a portion of that goes to fund the foundation at the University of Wyoming, and I'm all for the university. But this does not include any money going back to the tribes. It's solely fees going to the state of Wyoming. Be happy to try to answer any more questions.
Any other questions? Senator Hicks.
Mr. Chairman, just a quick question. It says an enrolled member of the Eastern Shoshone and an enrolled member. What's it take to be an enrolled member, and do we have any idea how many enrolled members that there currently are?
Senator Case, you want to answer that now, or you want to
wait?
Okay. Mr. President.
Mr. Chairman, that is a good question, and having been hail from that area, there are many, many folks on the reservation that are of Indian descent who are not enrolled that share the same heritage. And while, as the sponsor of the bill knows, I have a fond memory of this area. I attended school on the reservation when I was young. But this is the first time that I know of that we've gone out and made a special license plate that exists just because of the color of your skin, how you were born. I don't mean to belittle that. I don't want to belittle the pride that they should have as a member of their respective tribes. But when you look at firemen, when you look at veterans, those are things that we've offered to people because they've earned it as a result of special services they've provided in their lifetimes. It seems to me that with respect to, and with the university, we created a foundation. We said, go ahead and create these programs, and you have to contribute to create an endowment. And we've sent a lot of kids on scholarships. Now, if the tribes want to come in and say, look, we'd like to create a foundation program, and if you buy the specialty license plates, we'll create a scholarship program for people of Indian descent to go to better themselves, I could see that. But I really think you, while it's difficult to say it and it seems callous, it shouldn't be. We don't give, how about a license plate for those of us that are fourth, fifth, sixth generation Wyomingites? Because we're just a little bit different and specialized. There comes a point where you have to say that this is not the purpose of a license plate. These folks are Wyoming residents. They should buy licenses just like us. And it's a pretty interesting characterization that in most instances we would shun that use to identify one race or the other, whether they're indigenous to Wyoming or not.
Further discussion, Senator Anderson, 28.
Mr. Chairman, I question the page 2, line 11, and not include Arabic numerals for the county. Is that typical of those license plates, or is that special for these plates?
Any discussion? Senator Case, you want to address that question? And
with your permissions, Mr. Chairman, I could show you what a plate might look like.
That's fine.
Okay, thank you, Ms. So this is what happens where the county numbers would be. This is where the symbol goes. And these are just hypothetical symbols. So that's the issue of not including the county number. Instead, this symbol goes. How many members? I think there's about 5,000 or 6,000 Shoshone and 9,000 to 11,000 Arapahoes, Northern Arapahoes, depending on how you count the enrollment issue. The enrollment issue is very important to both tribes. I don't think you have to worry about them gaming the enrollment issue to accomplish getting more license plates, because the enrollment is what's very important to the tribal governments with respect to sharing of their mineral revenue. So that's, you know, they're actually kind of restrictive about it, enrollment, Mr. Chairman. And I do agree that there are folks on the reservation who, because of marriage and different bloodlines, they end up, descendants are not enrolled. It's definitely a possibility. Enrollment is their way of defining their government. It's the way, the ability for them to participate in tribal programs is derived. That comes from the treaties. Mr. Chairman, it is a concept that works for them, and they use it. So enrollment has benefits to be an enrolled tribal member. That is perhaps a foreign concept for this Senate, but it's not a reason to throw this bill out, because these are folks that have their government and their participation in Wyoming predates our statehood. And this is a chance for them to be proud of their culture, their heritage, and do so in a manner that doesn't impose any costs on the state of Wyoming. They're fully going to pay the extra fees, and they want to display these license plates. I really do not see the harm, and I find it kind of, I don't know, is it paternalistic from Cheyenne that we're going to say that they can't do this when we have many other kinds of license plates, and they're not just recognition plates for service. I think we should get the list of license plates and look at them, and you decide. There's only one that creates a foundation, and that is for the University of Wyoming, or participates in a foundation. The rest of them don't. We do have one of special recognition for disabled American veterans, and we discussed that one earlier. Obviously a very special plate. But all the others are kind of optional plates. And, Mr. Chairman, you know, if you wanted to amend this bill and allow anyone to buy one of these plates, that's absolutely fine with this sponsor. Just like I could buy, you know, that would remove the objection of the President of the Senate. I don't think people are going to buy these unless they're entitled to, and so I don't really see that as a problem. And he's about to pop up again, so let's let him.
Mr. President.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, my colleague will remember growing up in high school and back when we were in Fremont County Vocational High School, as we grew up in the grade schools, we did, the tribes did come, and we went to school together, went out there. And I can assure you that over and over you see hostility that will exist between those that found themselves enrolled and those that are not. Enrollment is a complicated issue. It is by percentage of your Indian descent, but also depends on sometimes whether it was your mother, it could be whether it's your father, or whether your parents undertook the necessary information to collect it so you can get enrolled. And I'm sure my colleague will remember growing up and seeing kids out there haze each other, whether you're enrolled or not enrolled. This is a business, really, that this legislature does not belong into. Now, I understand maybe say, okay, anybody can purchase one of these license plates, whether you're Caucasian, whether you're, if you simply support enrolled members. It's a bizarre notion. This is not the purpose of license plates, which is identify cars And it gets us into a position where we begin to walk down a pathway to begin to talk about racial differences for a license plate. And not only racial difference, but whether or not you happen to be 1/8 or 1/16. Maybe you missed it by 0.001%, and you don't get the license, but the other kid does. Or it might be your half-brother can get one. This is not an appropriate place for license plates.
Further discussion, Senator Byrne.
A question for the sponsor. I'm assuming most of these plates would be issued in Fremont County, although I'm assuming that if you're a registered member of the tribe living anywhere in the state, you can get one of these license plates. My question, I guess, applies more to Fremont County than any. You have a separate license plate with a separate symbol on the left side for one for Shoshone and one for Arapaho. Are there different numbering systems for each? And is there any chance of repeat numbers in Fremont County? So could you have a 1501 Fremont with a number 10 plate, 1501 with a Shoshone plate, and a 1501 with an Arapaho plate, which makes it, frankly, problematic for the police and highway patrol to properly identify the car?
Further discussion? Senator Hicks.
Mr. Chairman, just a question, because I'm trying to figure out on the enrollment, we have to be an enrolled member. So what I'm trying to figure out here, and I'm sure the sponsor will be able to help me out here, is there a card that you carry? So here's the process. You go into the county clerk's office, and you want one of these license plates, and you want to pay the fee, and it says you have upon proof of eligibility. So is each one of these enrolled members carry a card? So what is the proof of eligibility, I guess, is the question I want to know, Mr.
Thank you. Senator Case?
Well, Mr. Chairman, there is a tribal ID, and page 3 of the bill, lines 16 through 20, no license plate renewal or sticker shall be issued under this section without proof that the applicant is an enrolled member of the Eastern Shoshone Indian Tribe or the Northern Arapaho Tribe. So I would assume they'd show their cards. But they have a tribal ID. We recognize those tribal IDs as some form of legal identification. So I'm sure that's what they'd show. But, you know, just in terms of, let me answer a couple of the other questions, Mr. Chairman. We have disabled veteran license plate. Specialty plate, former prisoner of war, specialty plate, Pearl Harbor, firefighter, University of Wyoming, which is the one for the Inclusive Foundation. We have emergency medical technician. We have prestige license plates. We have the radio amateur license plate, we have the antique motor vehicle plate. There's some other things. We have an embossed license plate, and we have a special plate, Gold Star. And I might have missed a few in there. I just swung down the thing. So there are other categories, some of which are recognition plates in terms of, you know, this person is a veteran, and they're like that. But certainly amateur radio, I mean, I guess there might be some recognition there, but I'm not sure that stretches it to the extent that the case is trying to be made. Mr. Chairman, we can fix this by making these available to anyone, not being an enrolled member. I will bring that amendment on second reading. That solves the problem of the issues about enrollment and solves the problem that anyone might think that there's a racial element to this. And so I would ask that we let me bring that amendment, and then you decide. Because I think it's without having a discussion on that amendment, Mr. Chairman, we're kind of unfairly treating this proposed bill.
Further discussion. Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I rise in support of the bill. And I think for a lot of the reasons that the good senator from Fremont County said. But, you know, these are two sovereign nations in the middle of our state. And essentially, Mr. Chairman, I think that they're prideful people, and they want to tell people who they are when they're driving down the road. And you know, I see some of the other license plates that we have out there, and in comparison, I certainly think that these folks are certainly as worthy of a plate of probably quite a few of the other ones. So, Mr. Chairman, I think that there's been a lot of good points brought up that could make this a better bill, and I would hope that we would advance it to second reading, try to bring some of those amendments that you might be thinking of, and talk to the sponsor, see if we can make this a bill that we can all support for those folks up in Fremont County. Thank you, Mr. President.
Mr. President.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, on and against the bill. The issue of sovereignty is a complex issue, and the issue of sovereignty for water rights, everything, they're all complicated issues. But this belongs to the tribes. If the tribes want to issue to their members, their enrolled members, some type of an ID system that would be shown with some pride on their cards, let them do that. To the extent that they do have tribal sovereignty, that belongs to them. It's not the business of the state of Wyoming Department of Transportation to be embarked in this role. I urge you to reject the bill.
Any further discussion?
Just briefly, Mr.
Chairman. Senator Meyer.
I looked at the title, and it's pretty broad on line 4. It just says specifying requirements. So we could go in within the title if you wanted to make a foundation or if you wanted to direct that someplace else. So, you know, there's a lot of things that we can do on second reading. But, folks, we got to get it to second reading, and I would hope that you would support this piece of legislation.
Any further discussion? Senator Case.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. First of all, I didn't answer the question about the numbering system. I know that the numbering systems would be unique, and I understand the problem of confusion with two symbols. I know we can work that out. I have not talked to the Department of Transportation about that, but just to make sure that, you know, the number systems aren't duplicative. We've seen what happens when we had trucks that had that number and cars that had that number, and I understand that issue. And I know the Department of Transportation does as well, and I think it's a non-issue with the way they intend to administer this. The bigger picture is our relationship with the citizens of Wyoming that happen to live on the Wind River Indian Reservation is a very complex relationship. And it's a good and improving relationship. It's amazingly so. We work together on so many, many levels. We have state services that are there. We passed a liaison bill out of here that deals with that. It is a respectful, good, evolving, growing relationship. I fail to see any harm at all by letting citizens of Wyoming display plates depicting a symbolic of the Eastern Shoshone tribe or the Northern Arapaho tribe. I agree in part on the issues about enrollment. But that is something that we can fix and make these plates available to any citizen of Wyoming who should choose to do so. And it's a no-brainer. We help citizens of Wyoming show their pride. It doesn't cost the state anything, and it's a step forward in our relationship. I ask that you support this bill, and I will bring that amendment on second reading to remove the enrolled members.
Any further discussion? Questions been called. All those in favor of Senator Meyer's motion that when the committee of the whole rise and report it, do so with a due pass recommendation. On House Bill 120, say aye. Opposed?
No.
House Bill 120 has failed. Division's been called. Actually, I think it requires a standing division. I think it just requires a... all those in favor of House Bill 120, please stand. Eleven ayes. All those opposed? Noes. Pursuant to Senate Rule 6-5, having failed a standing division vote, a roll call vote is required. The chief clerk will call the roll.
Anderson, District 2?
No.
Anderson, District 28?
Aye.
Barnard?
Aye.
Bebout?
No.
Burns?
No.
Case?
Aye.
Christensen?
No.
Coe?
No.
Cooper? Kraft?
Aye.
Dockstader?
No.
Driscoll excused. Emmerich?
No.
Escobel?
Aye.
Geis?
Aye.
Hastert?
Aye.
Hicks?
No.
Johnson?
Aye.
Kinski?
No.
Landon?
No.
Meyer?
Aye.
Pappas? Perkins?
Aye.
Peterson?
No.
Ross?
No.
Rothfuss?
No.
Scott?
No.
Scott I? Von Fladern?
No.
Wasserberger?
No.
President Nicholas?
No.
Closing vote? Closing. Vote closed. 11 I, 18 no, 1 excused.
House Bill 120, having failed a roll call vote pursuant to Senate Rule 6-5A, is deemed indefinitely postponed. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 152. The clerk, reading clerk will read it.
House Bill number 152, Industrial Siding Impact Payments, sponsored by Representative Madden. It was referred to Committee Number 9, Mineral Business Economic Development, reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Senators Anderson, 28, Cole, Cooper, Rothfuss, Von Fladern, Senator Von Fladern, Chairman. It was reassigned to Committee Number 2, Appropriations, reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Senators Burns, Hastert, Perkins, Ross, Wasserberger, Senator Ross, Chairman.
I've heard the reading of the bill. What's your pleasure, Senator Von Fladern?
When the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with a due pass recommendation on House Bill 152, Industrial Siting Impact Payments, and I ask the Chair to please call on Senator Case to explain this bill.
Senator Case.
Feeling lucky, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. This bill is about industrial siting impact statements, and the problem that we have in Wyoming is that the industrial siting impact statements or impact payments don't follow the impact. And the problem is that they're based on a historical amount of sales tax collected. And the way we do it now is to take when a project is proposed to be started, we look at the 12 months immediately preceding sales tax revenues. And that average of those 12 months becomes the base year, Mr. Chairman. It's really important to think about that base year. And then how we provide for payments
is that we try to determine what changes, what economic changes have happened in that county, but we don't actually look at the real anything other than sales taxes collected. So we have a base level of sales tax revenue collected, and then we look and see how the county sales tax receipts change during the life of the project. And then what the state does is if the receipts for sales tax go up, then the state, in essence, matches those increases with impact statement, impact payments. I keep saying statement, I don't know why. But impact payments to the county. But the trouble is that payment amount is based on the actual sales tax received in the county, but it doesn't have anything to do with whether that's driven by the project or not. The real problem is that it depends on the overall level of economic activity in the county, which may be going up, maybe going down, maybe flat. But the impact payments don't match the project's impact on the county. This bill fixes that, Mr. Chairman, by having it try to, when the information is collected about the impact, they already know how much the project's going to cost. And so what this bill does is take the cost of the project and base the payments based on the cost of the project, Mr. Chairman, not going back to that base year. Because just think about it in the abstract a little bit. Suppose our economy is going into a doldrum. Suppose the general level of economic activity is going down, Mr. Chairman. What that means is if you pick any starting time and you pick the average sales tax collected for the past year, that's going to be a higher amount than the actual sales tax collected because the economy's we're going into a recession, for example, or we're on a downturn. Well, that means that when you make up the difference, it's negative. There is no impact, so that county gets no payments from industrial siting. If it's going the other way, they get a windfall, because if the general level of economic activity is going up, and then we base the base year is based on an average of a year before, and then everything past that, the sales tax collections are actually higher. The impact statements are based on the difference between the sales tax collections and the base year. So they get a windfall, even though that increase in sales tax may not be caused by the project. It may be more caused by the overall increase in the county's economy. That's the problem. The other problem that has happened is that we have given out this perverse formula means that we have given out impact payments when there's virtually no activity happening at the project. All they have to do is begin, turn over a shovel full of dirt. Then all these impact payments are triggered, which until the project is officially over, there is no additional contribution to the economy from the project, no impact at all, but because they started construction, quotation marks, we have to start make payments, and we have done that on several occasions. What this bill does is match up the payments with the impacts. It's supported by the executive branch agencies, and it sounds a bit complicated, but it actually doesn't involve collecting any more data than they already collect. So, Mr. Chairman, if you want to, we can get right to the heart of it. Again, like all our sales and use taxes, that's the basis of it, we have parallel statutory construction. One section for sales tax, one section for use tax. So we only have to go through half the bill when we get the gist of it, Mr. Chairman. So, Mr. Chairman, on page 2, as you can see, line 20, it moves from the State Treasurer to the Department of Revenue, but it's actually is the Department of Revenue anyway. That's more like a housekeeping thing. And we no longer, you can see on the top of page 3, where it talked about how the payments should be made. The old language said, each payment to the county treasurer shall be equal to the excess of monthly payment made under paragraph B of this section during the period of construction over the base period amount. We're going to get rid of the base period amount, and we're going to determine the amount to be paid in a proceeding. So that's why the language on line 6 and 7 says an amount determined by the Industrial Siting Council under this subsection. Mr. Chairman, the meat of it is lines 15 on page 3 and continuing over the next page. The person constructing the industrial facility and the counties affected by the construction of the industrial facility shall provide evidence at the public hearing held pursuant to WS 3512110F little I, that's a hearing they already hold, of the mitigated and unmitigated impacts that the construction will have on the counties, cities, and towns determined by the Industrial Siting Council to be affected by the construction of the industrial facility. The Industrial Siting Council shall review the evidence of the impacts and determine, applying a predominance of the evidence standard, the dollar amount of the unmitigated impacts. The Council shall state in the order issued under that hearing the total dollar amount of the impact assistance payment, so they're going to know what the total amount is, and the reasons for determining that amount, meaning where did they get that number and where is it going to go. The impact assistance payment shall be distributed by the Department of Revenue in an amount and on a schedule determined by the Council based on the evidence presented at the hearing. Under no circumstances shall the impact assistance payment exceed 2.76% of the total estimatable material costs of the facility as those costs are determined by the Council. Mr. Chairman, that's not a magic number. 2.76 is the distribution of sales tax amount that the project would have generated for the county. That is the total estimated material costs. So 2.76% of the total estimated material costs of the project are the total amount that can be distributed as impact. And you see that it makes it real because we're distributing it based on the real cost of the project. It's an estimated cost, but it's of the cost of that project. We don't fool with a base year. We don't have the ups and downs, the overpayments, the underpayments, and it's a better system, Mr. Chairman, supported by your Department of Revenue, supported by the executive branch. I stand for questions.
Any questions? Are you ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Von Flatern's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rise and report, to do so with a due pass recommendation on House Bill 152, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? House Bill 152 is passed Committee of the Whole. Next bill for our consideration is House Bill 174. The reading clerk will read it.
House Bill number 174, Nicotine Products Regulation, sponsored by Representative Walters. It was referred to Committee number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Kraft, Driscoll, Landon, Peterson, and Scott, Senator Scott, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Senator Scott?
Mr. Chairman, I move from the Committee of the Whole rise and report it do so with the recommendation that House Bill 174 do pass. There was a standing committee amendment. I ask it be read in at this time.
Reading clerk will read in the amendment.
House Bill number 174, standing committee amendment number 1 to engross copy, page 3, line 8.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman. I move adoption standing committee amendment, and to explain both the amendment and the bill, I yield to Senator Wasserberger.
Senator Wasserberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And you can see on page 3, line 8, essentially what we do is we are going to define a liquid nicotine container, which means a bottle or other container of a liquid or other substance containing nicotine where the liquid or substance is sold, marketed, or intended for use in a vapor product. A liquid nicotine container shall not include a liquid or other substance containing nicotine in a cartridge that is sold, marketed, or intended for use in a vapor product, provided that the cartridge is prefilled and sealed by the manufacturer and not intended to be opened by the consumer. And then on page 4, line 7, we insert that we delete all e-liquid and insert any liquid nicotine container, and we do that throughout the bill. One more time on page 4, line 14, and then on page 4, line 19, we make a technical correction on $1,500 for the second fine if this should happen. But ultimately, we put a comma after the 1,000, so it makes it 1,500. So that's a technical correction. And I would move the standing committee amendment at this time and stand for questions.
Any discussion on the standing committee amendment? Are you ready for the question on the standing committee amendment? All those in favor of Senator Scott's motion to adopt the standing committee amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? That amendment's been adopted. We're back on the bill. Senator Wasserberger.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. We are back on the bill. The purpose of this bill is to address public health, education, and child safety issues in regard to tobacco products and accidental poisoning. What this bill does, and it may cause some heartburn for some, it prohibits the possession and use of tobacco products on school grounds, licensed preschools, and certified products or certified daycares during posted hours of operation. Wyoming does not have consistent policy governing the use of tobacco products on school grounds, licensed preschools, and certified daycare facilities. Because of the absence of FDA oversight, the bill creates the vapor product safety under Wyoming Statutes 35-7-1801, public health and safety, which includes child-resistant packaging of e-liquids and vapor products. Packaging requirements are subject to the Poison Prevention Packaging Act of 1970, and pre-filled containers sealed by the manufacturer meet this requirement, and establishes enforcement by the Consumer Health Services Division of the Department of Agriculture. And what the issue is there are no federal requirements that e-liquid be packed in child-proof or tamper-resistant packaging, and that's what this bill does. Nor are manufacturers or retailers required to place warning labels on the bottles. As a result of the lack of control, the Centers of Disease Control and Prevention reported in April 2014 that the number of calls to poison centers involving e-cigarette liquids containing nicotine rose from 1 per month in September 2010 to 215 per month in February 2014. More than half, 51.1%, of the calls to poison centers due to e-cigarettes involved young children under the age of 5. And about 42% of the poison calls involve people age 20 and older. The bill defines alternative nicotine products, smokeless tobacco products and vapor products. It requires that peer-reviewed science-based educational materials be available on those products in regard to tobacco harm reduction and the comparative risks under the Tobacco Settlement Fund. The Tobacco Vapor Electronic Cigarette Association urges that all members sell the e-liquids with child-proof caps. The vapor industry and independent retail operators recognize that it is time to add a modicum of safety to protect children from accidental poisoning. And members of the Senate, let me walk you through this bill. It says, on page 2, it prohibits the use of tobacco products on school grounds, licensed preschools, and certified daycares during posted hours of operation. This bill creates the vapor product safety section under Wyoming Statutes 35-7-1801, public health and safety. And we move on to page 3. Child-resistant packaging, e-liquids, and vapor products are defined in lines 1 through 6. Child-resistant packaging requirements are subject to the Poison Prevention Packaging Act of 1970. And that act requires that the term special packaging means packaging that is designed or constructed to be significantly difficult for children under age 5 years to open or obtain a toxic or harmful amount of the substance contained therein within a reasonable time and not difficult for normal adults to use properly. And then, Mr. Chairman, we get to page 3, line 8. And that's where we inserted the amendment that we passed just a few minutes ago. And then also vapor product. Vapor product is a non-combustible product containing liquid nicotine that includes electronic cigarettes, cigars, cigarillos, pipes, or similar products or devices. And we move on to page 4, lines 5 through 23, where it says 35-7-1802 is created and defines child-resistant packaging requirements. Child-resistant packaging is required for all e-liquids sold. This section does not address other smokeless tobacco products. In B, it says pre-filled containers sealed by the manufacturer meet this requirement, and a violation of this subsection is a misdemeanor with a fine up to $750 for the first violation and not more than $1,500 for each subsequent violation. Lines 21 through 23 on page 4 and continuing over to lines 1 through 4 on page 5 establishes enforcement by the Consumer Health Division, Services Division of the Department of Agriculture. The division's inspection of enforcement duties under this section may be performed by a county or local health department. And then on page 5, lines 14 through 19, 9-4-1204, little a, tobacco settlement funds, reduction of tobacco use is amended to include peer-reviewed science-based educational materials on tobacco harm and reduction. And then finally, Mr. Chairman, page 6, lines 1 through 21, we have definitions are added to 9-4-1204 for alternative nicotine products, smokeless tobacco products, tobacco products. And then finally, on page 7, lines 1 through 16, it defines vapor product under 9-4-1204, and line 18 provides for an effective date of July 1, 2015. And Mr. Chairman, that is the bill. And I stand for questions at this time.
Senator Hicks.
Mr. Chairman, I've got a question on page 2. It creates a new section, 14.3309, and it's the use of tobacco products on school grounds, and it provides that all tobacco products will be prohibited on school grounds. The question I have on this section is what are the penalties for violating the prohibition? And who's responsible for enforcing the prohibition on school grounds? If we get a little discussion here, and then I have some additional questions, Mr. Chairman, but I'll wait to ask those in a moment.
Senator Wasserberger.
Well, Mr. Chairman, actually, that's a good question. And always before, on school grounds, at least in the school districts that I represent, they are tobacco-free campuses now. So, as we know, in the age of 18, any student under the age of 18 is not to have any tobacco products whatsoever. What this does, essentially, and also we do not allow any adult to use any tobacco products on school grounds anywhere within the districts that I represent. But who would be enforcing that, I guess, would be law enforcement, but also your handy-dandy local principals and administrators. But we wouldn't be, giving tickets. We would be asking you not to smoke or not to chew or whatever.
Further discussion, Senator Barnard.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not opposed to any of these articles that are in this bill, but I thought that when we have a bill that just should do one primary thing, and this looks like an omnibus smoking bill to me, because it does three different things. It tells you you can't smoke on a school thing. It talks about a cessation program, and it talks about packaging for smoking. So it's all these things in one bill.
Senator Anderson, 28.
On page 2, we define school grounds and schools and 1 through 12 and licensed preschools, et cetera. What about homeschools? Are they covered under this, or can you smoke at a homeschool?
Who wants to handle that? Senator Hicks.
Mr. Chairman, I think in the presentation by the presenter, he already got to my point. Right now, this criminal, it provides a provision for about a third of the parents in my district. They can't go on school grounds anymore if they drive up to pick their child up from school and they've got their can of chew sitting on the front console of their pickup or their car in their pocket. We've just created a prohibition for the parents. I don't think that's what the intent is. And the question I really have is, and I think it was already alluded to, the schools already have the authority under 14.3308 to do this. What this does is now make it absolutely a prohibition against the parents from even driving onto the campus to pick up their children. Just think it's a little too broad, Mr. Chairman. Not against the bill. I think the bill's a good idea, but certainly I think we probably need to look at a second reading amendment on that provision, Mr. Chairman.
Further discussion? Seeing none, are you ready for the question?
Question.
Mr. McCall, all those in favor of Senator Scott's motion that when the committee of the whole rise to report to do so with a due pass recommendation on House Bill 174. Say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Senator.
House Bill 174 is passed Committee of the Whole. Next bill for our consideration is House Bill 144. Chief Clerk will read the, or the reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill number 144, Education, School Safety and Security. Sponsored by the Education Committee. It was referred to Committee Number 4, Education. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Anderson, O2, Coe, Dockstader, Pappas, and Rothfuss, Senator Co-Chairman. It was re-referred to Committee Number 2, Appropriations. Who reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Burns, Hastert, Ross, Wasserberger, no, Senator Perkins, Senator Ross, Chairman.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Coe, what's your pleasure?
Move when the committee of the whole rise and report it do so with due pass recommendation on House Bill 144, Education, School Safety and Security. There is a standing committee amendment. I'd ask that it be read in at this time.
Reading clerk will read in. Standing Committee Amendment Number 1.
House Bill Number 144, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to engrossed copy. Page 1, line 3.
Senator Coe.
Mr. Chairman, I'd move that amendment and draw your attention to some handouts that we sent out here that will help you as we proceed through the bill. School safety tip line and enhanced strategy, because that's what we're going to be talking about. And this copy here of a safe to tell, which is what you're going to hear a lot about in the explanation of the bill. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'd defer to Senator Rothfuss for an explanation.
Mr. Minority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I bring House Bill 144, Education, School Safety and Security. Mr. Chairman, this was an interim topic that the Joint Education Committee tackled. And it's one that we've been looking at for the last couple of years. We've been trying to find policies that can address safety and security in schools. There's been a lot of discussion. There was a task force put together that involved the AG, the Department of Homeland Security, a number of legislators, a number of other groups, to try and figure out what the top priorities are and what could be done that would be reasonable for our schools to help protect the students in our schools. This piece of legislation actually started off with three different pieces. Regrettably, two of those pieces proved not to be workable yet. They need more work, and we cut those out. Those were trimmed in the House. But one of the key programs that we put a lot of attention on in the interim is what's being brought to you in House Bill 144 at this point, which is the Safe to Tell program, and that's the purpose of this House Bill 144 is to implement that. We had a presentation from the director of this program down in Colorado that has implemented it over the past, I think, 10 years is how long they've had it. And you've got a nice sheet talking about it on this data to report. Dating clear back to 2004-2005, when that program started in Colorado, they began this Safe to Tell program, and you can see that it's grown over the years. If you look at the lower left-hand corner, the number of tips and reports they've received has increased significantly to the point where they're getting almost 3,200 reports in the 2013-14 school year. The program has been very successful. The evidence was very compelling, and the program was started after the Columbine tragedy that took place a little over a decade ago now. That tragedy led Colorado to look seriously at what they could do. And there was a U.S. Secret Service Safe School Initiative study of school shootings and other school-based attacks that found that perpetrators exhibited behavior concerning to others prior to the violent incident in 93% of school violence cases. In other words, 93% of the time when you have these types of tragedies, there are good warning signals out there that nobody listens to. This Safe to Tell program was put together to try and address that and find a way to get students, get people to feel comfortable about talking, about telling what they've heard in an anonymous forum, report that back to an entity that's capable of actually doing something about it, and in doing so, circumventing or heading off these types of incidents. And when you look at this data that we've had provided to us on behalf of the Colorado program, you can see how effective it is. You look at bullying at the top, which is the most significant, but you can also see below circumstances of guns, weapons, planned school attacks. There have been a lot of reports. This program has worked effectively in Colorado, and it's our hope that it will work as well in the state of Wyoming when we move it into place. Mr. Chairman, you do have good data available to you for the Colorado program, and you've got a discussion of where we're at right now. As I mentioned, one of the highest priorities in trying to maintain safety and security in schools is trying to prevent these by identifying early behaviors and difficulties that students are having. Currently in Wyoming, we have an anonymous tipping platform based on a staffed answering service concept, which is physically located in California, called WeTip. We've had this in place since 2007, and it's received only 200 calls over that time. So it has done some valuable things in those 200 calls, but regrettably, the fact that it's in California inhibits the program's ability to have ongoing dialogue with the local agencies and schools. And many of the tips are received by agencies, sometimes by letter, several days after the tip was received. It's not an effective program or as effective as we want it to be. We hope to do a lot better in the future. It's not responsive. It's not quick. There's no immediate feedback, and there's no ability to respond rapidly. That's a big difference from the Safe to Tell program that we're looking at implementing through House Bill 144. Safe to Tell is very different. It's an interactive strategic framework developed on the principles of educating young people, parents, community members, and school staff on critical issues, encouraging them to be part of the preventative solution and equipping them with a tangible, direct way to report information anonymously and empowering them to make a difference. One of the key concepts, and you'll see it in the legislation in the bill, is the anonymity and the fact that this relies on the tools that students use, social networking, texting, cell phones, all of the things that the students will use and will feel comfortable as a means of contacting. They will have an available resource to report, and then that resource, which you'll see in the legislation, would be implemented through our DCI in the AG's office, will have operators 24/7. They already do. They've got their op center. This simply augments that op center and gives them a responsibility to respond to these incidents. They respond immediately. They take action at that time. They follow up on every one of the reports, follow it through its completion, make sure all of the appropriate entities are engaged, and then see it through to a conclusion, which is very different, obviously, than the system we have in place right now. That's how it's been done to the state south of us. It's been very effective, and we look forward to trying to engage in that way also. Another component of this program is an outreach, education, and collaboration with staff and community members at schools. It goes out, it teaches, it provides literature, and it tries to, through a communication marketing strategy, engage the students, the teachers, and the members in our schools. It tries to meet the needs of individual schools and communities by effectively creating positive change in the safety culture of Wyoming schools. And it further enhances student success by following up on all information received to ensure appropriate response was provided. This information is passed along to the appropriate agency, school, and community member immediately, as I mentioned, via phone and computer programming to ensure timely response. So the level of rigor, the level of follow-up is significantly enhanced through this program, Mr. Chairman, I'll take a look and walk through the bill. That's the intent of the program. Now we'll take a look at how it's implemented. You can see on page 1 going on to page 2, under the Attorney General in 91641, the creation of the Unit of School Safety and Security is created, as well as the appointment of a deputy to put in charge of it. It's in the Division of Criminal Investigation, DCI, and that deputy is designated in little B there to supervise and direct all the activities of the School Unit Safety and Security Program. Moving on to bottom of page 2, the Unit of School Safety and Security and the duties of the deputy. The deputy is then responsible for supervising and directing all the activities of the unit, as well as serving as the state's representative on local school and national organizations involved in school safety and security, as well as, on page 3, acting as the authority on necessary components on school safety and security plans and acting as a liaison with local government entities. This is something that will help to coordinate our security endeavors statewide. We already have DCI and Homeland Security to some degree engaged. They were the ones who contributed to this and strongly support this piece of legislation and passionately supported it in committee, recognizing that prevention is the key to solving a lot of these problems. In this method, we actually will have a liaison that can work with all of the school districts, provide expert information, and try and coordinate and formulate local crisis management plans and other coordinated safety endeavors within the school districts, working with the school districts to improve their safety measures. The rest of page 3 indicates that this deputy would oversee the program, the Safe to Tell type program that we'll be discussing, provide public information and education, and promulgate rules and regulations through DCI and the Attorney General's office to fulfill this program. On page 4, it talks about the Unit of School Safety Security and the program that's created, this Safe to Tell style program, which shall include methods of anonymous reporting concerning unsafe, potentially harmful, dangerous, violent, or criminal activities in the schools, and then provide alternate means of reporting, including telephone, website, mobile telephone applications, and cellular text messaging. In other words, once again, trying to engage in social media and other approaches that make the students more comfortable rather than strictly relying on a phone line. In Romanet 2 on page 4, you see the anonymity portions, that it ensures the identity of the reporting parties remains unknown to all persons and entities, including law enforcement officers and employees operating the program. It's anonymous to everyone. This is a very strict and very rigorous anonymity control, and you can see even on line 4 that it only allows for the disclosure, page 4 in Romanet 3, only allows for the disclosure of information to law enforcement officers specifically if on page 5 you see there's a voluntary disclosure of the identity and verifies that that individual is willing to be identified. So the anonymity is protected unless they're willing to provide their name. On page 5, it continues to discuss the anonymity. On Romanet 5, on page 5, you see that the entity is required to promptly share necessary information received in operation of the program with the appropriate law enforcement and public safety agency or school district officials. And you'll see further language a little bit later in the bill. They're required to immediately respond under these circumstances. Romanet 6 indicates that you'll establish training protocols and safety, security, and safety and program security awareness. In Romanet 7, it provides educational materials to the schools. You can see on page 6, the Unit of School Safety and Security is created and how the information is handled. First of all, the information and the records recorded by this TIPS operation is deemed not to be a public record and shall remain confidential. In little b, persons implementing or operating the program shall not be compelled to produce any materials from the program except with the discussion below. Under certain court proceedings where the criminal defendant to the court makes a specific motion, and then the requirements you can see in Romanets 1 through moving on to actually page 8, discussion of how that motion would operate. It's under hearings in chambers, and the judge would have to determine that there is exculpatory evidence providable for it to be admissible. And then on page 8, the little C indicates that that information shall be sealed in court records to preserve the record as confidential to the greatest degree possible. Section 2, as we see, indicates this is where we begin the program. This is the appropriation language. It started off from Joint Education Committee as having 5 permanent full-time positions. That was reduced in the other chamber down to 3. The standing committee amendment that we have, which If it hasn't been moved, I'll move it now. I'll just go ahead and move it. I move Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 144 and ask the body for favorable consideration. It may have already been moved. What the amendment does is take that back to the original Joint Education Committee recommendation of 5 full-time equivalents. And the reason for that is this is the number that is needed by the DCI Operations Center so that they can make sure that they always have 2 or more operators in place. Justification for that being you don't want to be put on hold when you have an emergency like this. And if we had less than that, if there's 4 or 3 hired, there is a chance of being put on hold. So you've got a tragic situation coming up. You call up DCI, and they say, please hold. 5 is the minimum number. That's the reason we have this number. And the Standing Committee Amendment preserves that number. There's some cleanup language. If we go to the Standing Committee Amendment right now, the first 10 lines are actually cleanup language, just amending the title to reflect some of the changes that were put in by the House, which are good changes. It goes through changes 3 to 5, changes the enactment time because the enactment was actually changed in the House, so the July 1st, 2015 needs to change on the effective date. Some of the lines relative to specific positions on page 8, lines 15 through 18 were taken out. There's no reason to call out the specific positions. There are 5 that are needed, one of which is the deputy and the other 4 are the operators. And then it goes on to amend the language of the actual appropriations in accordance with that change. So the $410,000 from the $265,000 recognizes the additional costs for those positions. And then the final change on the amendment I'll get to momentarily. That's on lines 36 and beyond because I'll explain what it's doing first. You see on page 9 in little B, the $225,000 is for the operation of the program from the enactment date to June 30th, 2016. That's all the materials and other operations, including the software and everything else that needs to go into the program. And then little C on line 9, again, was originally in legislation. It was amended over in the House, and it says the funds and positions appropriated by these sections shall be reduced by any unexpended funds and transferred positions appropriate to the department being the Department of Education. In other words, trying to transfer some funds that already went towards school security and move them over to this program. Now, in testimony from the superintendent and from others, it turns out that not all of those funds can go. There are $45,000 in that fund that would be able to be moved on an annual basis. There's no problem with that. But some of the other funds are in programs that would continue to operate and can't be moved over. So you see in lines 36 through 44 of the amendment a change to allow the $45,000 to move over, but the rest of the materials, which would not be fungible, not to move over, and that's a maintenance. So, Mr. Chairman, that is both the bill. You can see on page 10, the last bit of the bill is just an effective date on section 3 of basically immediately. And that's the amendment. So, Mr. Chairman, I would call for a question on the amendment if there are no questions on the amendment. It looks like there are. So I'll answer.
Question on the Standing Committee Amendment. Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I'm scratching my head here to find out what these guys are actually going to be doing. You get 5 full-time employees that are basically, I think they're just waiting there for a school to call up and says, we've got a gunman in the hall. And if that's the case, then I can't remember more than one, if one, in the last 10 years that these people would even have anything to do. I mean, sign me up for this one, Mr. Chairman. I'll take that job.
Senator Rothfuss.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll answer that one quickly. My apologies. I didn't make it clear that these are DCI operators. They already exist. There are 7 of them right now. This takes the I think 6 of them right now. This takes the number up to 10, I believe. So they are already employed. They already exist. It's just that they don't have 2 of them on staff at the same time. So there is the possibility of being on hold. They are the ones that coordinate law enforcement operations throughout the state on behalf of DCI. They're very busy. They have a lot of work. This is the minimum number that would need to be added to ensure that there are always 2. It's a 24/7 operation currently. So they're there already. They're already 24/7. It's just that there are 4 days a week during which there are 3 shifts I think I've got those numbers wrong. There are a few shifts on those 4 days a week that only have one operator working at a time. This is the number that would be needed to be added so that there are always two or more operators on shift. So again, these are not going to be people sitting around waiting for a call for the WeTip line. This is adding additional responsibilities to DCI staff that are already acting as operators, giving them additional responsibility, and then recognizing that the program doesn't work well if you have only one DCI employee who might be handling a field call for other DCI operations and has to say, I'm sorry, please wait, Timmy, or whatever the case may be. So that was unclear, and I apologize for that, Senator, that I didn't clarify.
Further discussion on the Standing Committee Amendments. Senator
okay.
Meyer.
Nope, not on the
All right. Any discussion on the Standing Committee Amendment? Question's been called. All those in favor of Senator Coe's motion to adopt the Standing Committee Amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Standing Committee Amendment number one has been adopted. We are back on the bill. Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Little discussion about what the penalty would be on page four if someone had false reporting. Because I can see high school kids using that anonymity in ways that might be a little more than mischievous.
Further discussion, Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a couple of questions. And I'm looking at the Data 2 report, Safe to Tell. I guess this is from Colorado. And the first question is, there's quite a few more students, a lot bigger high schools. I'm not sure how what happens in Colorado relates to Wyoming, where we've got our largest district is probably so much smaller than their largest district. We have so many rural districts. The other thing, Mr. Chairman, is we always talk about results or outcomes. And I look at bullying, and it's like, I can't quite read it, 3,000. So does that mean that 3,000 times someone said, I'm being threatened or bullied? And then if that's the case, what was the follow-up? What was the outcome? If you're going to have people taking these calls, what do? Then you call the local law enforcement 3,000 times and have them go out to the school and get involved and do an investigation. Suicide intervention, terrible thing that happens to our young people. Do you do like a Title 25 where they would go have an involuntary every time there's a report? Do you have the social services people go into all of those different things? What are the results? What shows us that it works? To me, when they show you get a lot of calls, that shows nothing. What you have to have are results that show where there's a benefit, and I don't see any benefits in this that would show that and show us that it's a program that would work for Wyoming.
Senator Coe.
Well, Mr. Chairman, that's one of the reasons that we're so interested in this program, and I have to tell the body that when we had the presentation of the Joint Education Committee from this lady down in Colorado, it's one of the most powerful presentations I've ever witnessed and sat in on. No question about it that, this program works. And whether or not you want to say, you know, how we do it, five here, seven there, whatever, if we can intercept and keep one bad thing from happening in Wyoming like Sandy Hook or Columbine, it's worthwhile. The reason it happens this way is because the Safe to Tell program, with the people that are manning the phones at DCI, they follow up. If they get a bullying call, they follow up and go to the school. They call the school. If they get a suicide possibility, they do the same thing or go to the appropriate local people in that community where the tip came from. So the great thing about this program compared to the WeTips that we have right now is it has verifiable follow-up that takes place. That's what has to happen. If you have a gun situation, you know, one of the reasons why DCI is doing this is because they're the law enforcement entity that has the ability to understand the severity of a possible gun problem. So I hope that answers your question. But I want to say one thing. This bill started out, the Joint Education Bill started out with a discussion of school safety, and that was a Management Council assignment to us. And we started out with lengthy debates on school resource officers, SROs, all kinds of different stuff. And what the House has really done with this bill is stripped everything out but this program, because this is a good program. I am sold on it. I think it's one of the neatest things that I've ever seen out there, and if it has any prevention to it, I'm just going to be tickled to death. So the main reason is I think there's follow-up with DCI that makes it advantageous.
Mr. Jordy, floor leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And my colleague explained it very well, and I really respect his enthusiasm for this. If there's a lot of benefits and a lot of these calls were followed up, then where are the results? Tell me what they are. We all want safe schools, but we don't want to spend money on something that's not really going to do what we want. And I'm still get back to the question of where do we see the indication that it's beneficial, and show me how it's helped in these different areas rather than just how many people made a phone call.
Mr. President.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess, we do want to support our interim work, but I do have a lot of questions with respect to this. Traditionally, DCI has been a pretty unique in agency. It is under the auspices of the Attorney General. If you look at its duties, it's to assist state and county local enforcement requests when they're requested for detecting crime, enforcing criminal statutes. One of the big areas is that they, if they're directed by the governor to get involved, they get involved. If they're suspected of violations of the Wyoming Controlled Substances Act, they get involved. So they've got a pretty narrow mission. And when you see DCI folks show up in the community, the first thing that you think is you got a drug-related issue going on. And these are people that don't wear uniforms. They are different. They operate differently than your local law enforcement. Most of us have, I'm not sure about the smaller communities, but I know the larger communities do have SROs. They have community, they have a program that's designed to have police officers in uniforms around, getting comfortable with students, being involved. If you have an issue, you know to dial 911. And it seems to me that the real coordination for protecting your schools needs to come from your local law enforcement. Now, if they want to reach out to get support, but we already have these 911 programs in the communities, and I worry that in the effort to address this issue, you do get an overkill. I see a $3 million fiscal note on the white copy of the bill. We see new personnel to be in Cheyenne. What we don't see is this coordination of local efforts and people trying to figure out how they control these activities local. So I think this bill, as it sits today, deserves some more scrutiny as we talk.
Further discussion. See ya. Further discussion, Senator Landon.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. To pick up on the previous speaker and that line of thinking, I can only say that, what's intriguing about this program, fellow senators, is that this is information we're not going to get. It's fine to say that we want our local law enforcement officers to coordinate all of this effort, but the fact is they're not going to get this information. The majority floor leader asked for results, and the only thing that I can pass along from the interim is an anecdotal story that really hit home for me. And that was, there was a young man down in Colorado playing a video game, one of those online games that the young people play, and this friend of his, it was an online friend, and you remember he was down in the state of Mississippi, I believe it was, or maybe Louisiana, and they were playing this game, and the young man from Colorado indicated to his buddy down in the south, he said, "I'm not going to be on this game tomorrow."
And the young man picked up on the fact that this kid was in trouble. And so he called it in. He called it into this Safe to Tell program. They went over to his house and not only intercepted him, he was going to commit suicide, but he was going to take people out with him. And they found a whole bunch of guns. So that's one anecdotal story that may very well have prevented a tragedy at another school down in Colorado. This is a conversation, Senators. I don't blame the reluctance and the hesitation, but it's kind of akin to the conversation that we had with school facilities. You know, chairing that committee, I stood up here and had to admit to you, I don't know how big that's going to get. I don't know how secure we can make those buildings out there. All we can do is take our best shot at some of this, and throughout the interim, we were very impressed with this report right here. And I do think it's working down south. I certainly think it's worth a try, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
All right. Senator Anderson.
Thank you. If I may, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to talk a minute about results and outcomes. You know, this program that we've described to you is a prevention program. So the success is in what you don't see. You're dealing with things like bullying, suicide or potential suicide, violence, and abuse. You get out ahead of those things, the real tragedy never happens. And so that doesn't show up on any kind of an incident report. It's what you prevent. Many of us have had cancer. We caught it early. The treatment that we got prevented the actual undesired outcome. And that's much like any preventive program. It's what you don't see is where the success is. You get out ahead of the problem, you nip it in the bud, and you prevent it from the worst case of ever happening. I'd hope you'd support the bill.
Further discussion, Senator Hicks.
Mr. President, I think there's been some outstanding points made here, but I think the one point that I want to bring up to the body is preventative medicine is the best thing. And when we design preventative programs, whether you're going down the interstate highway, we can mine the statistics and tell you what's the probability that you're going to have a wreck on an interstate versus a number of 100,000 people that go down there. So we do actuarial studies and we determine what's the probability and what's the risk of driving on an interstate instead of a secondary highway or a county road. We mine that information and then we make good decisions on how we remediate. Let's use the example of healthcare. We can pull the statistics out right now and we can say what's the probability of somebody age 55 getting colorectal cancer in the state of Wyoming or skin cancer in the state of Wyoming? What populations are at risk? What's the demographic distribution of those populations within our society? I think we all want school safety. But I'm a little concerned here that we're doing a shotgun approach and we're comparing apples with oranges. We don't have large municipal urban populations like they do in our neighbor to the south. We have very urban demographics. And how do those statistics carry up? What's the probability that we're going to have a shooter? Let's go back and look at the statistics. Where do those occur? What age do they occur? What demographics within those communities occur? Then we can make surgical good decisions and apply that money where it's going to be best used. Now, I think this is probably a good program, but I don't know. And at some point in time, we've got to rely on the education committee. But before we as a body can make good decisions, we have to have good information. And a good information in this case, I think, is what we need is a good risk assessment. What is the highest risk that we face within the state of Wyoming? What's the difference between rural schools and our larger schools? I think the data is out there. I think we can mine that data, and then we can develop those programs to be cost-efficient and directed to achieve those results that we want. I'm a little concerned about just using analogies from other states that really don't reflect the type of populations and communities we have. So I think it's a good idea, but I think we need to look at this and we need to conduct a risk analysis and say, what are the highest risks? Is it suicide? Is it bullying? Is it active shooter? And in what kind of schools may or may not occur? There's information out there that can be had, Mr. Chairman. I just think this is a little premature at this point in time.
Senator Coe.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I know we can sit back and we can say, ain't going to happen in Wyoming. We aren't like our neighbors to the south with large metropolitan areas. But it's already happened in Wyoming. We had the Cokeville incident. We had an incident up in Sheridan some 10 or 12 years ago. So it can happen here. You know, the research shows that in 81% of the violent incidents in U.S. schools, someone other than the attacker knew it was going to happen but failed to report it. Now, just some things to talk about success of the program, Courage to Tell. Here's just a few of the things that have worked in our neighbors to the south. A tip received reveals a gun on an elementary school bus, leading to it being confiscated. Second one, police refer mother of aggressive kindergartner to area mental health programs for assistance. Third, student takes responsibility for harassment allegations after Safe to Tell tip submitted and investigated. Fourth, local law enforcement following up to alleged sexual abuse by stepfather. Those are just a few of those. So this can happen in Wyoming. This is a good program. I'd ask you to move it forward and pass the bill.
Any further discussion? Senator Rothfuss.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the discussion and the points and the concern for the school safety. I wanted to clarify one point before I sat down, and I don't see the president, actually. I was going to answer his question about the $3.3 million in the original fiscal note. That's for portions of the $3.3 million in the original fiscal note is for portions of the bill that are no longer in the bill. Those deal with school resource officers. That was cut out, so that's not there anymore. The current fiscal note is $635,000, and that's reflected in the discussion that we had on the amendment. I just wanted to clarify that before we took the vote. I'd be happy to answer any other questions, but it sounds like we're ready for a vote. Well, maybe not.
Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, I still haven't heard anything about the penalties when people false report and they're anonymous. And what's going to happen, because I really think that's going to just balloon the bullying in this process. And so that still is a concern of mine, Mr. Chairman. And I think a lot of local school districts have already done this, have already made provisions for suicide prevention in their schools, have already made provisions for problems with guns. They've got separation, buzzing systems on all the schools now, so you just can't walk in the front doors like you used to. You know, we've been talking about this for a long time, but the folks out there that might have a problem, they've already been implementing, I think, successful programs in their local schools to address the problem because they're basically had the flexibility and the local control to do the job. So, Mr. President, there's always places we can, you know, you can call. There's 911. There's operators on that line all the time. They could possibly be trained a little bit to give information. There's other places, 411, if somebody wants to call up just information and try to get a local number so they can report it to the law enforcement or someplace else. There's other avenues to reach this problem that we're perceiving we're having.
Senator Wasserberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to rise in support of this bill, and the bill has received a number of haircuts all the way through, and now we are down to essentially the choice between what is called WeTip, which costs the state, I believe, about $50,000 a year. And then this one, which is called Safe to Tell Tip Report Line. And the difference between WeTip
as a building principal, we've had WeTip for a long time, and I don't know how many years. But literally, we received a letter that was sent from WeTip to local law enforcement, and then law enforcement came to the school. And that was maybe 2 weeks after the original report of somebody calling into WeTip that something was wrong. Imagine if that was a student who was going to contemplate suicide or something. What this does, essentially, the Safe to Tell program, it's staffed 24/7, 365. It's staffed in DCI, but if a call comes in, you're made aware of it as a building administrator or as a guidance counselor as soon as they can possibly get to you. And if they can't get to the schools, then they're going to go to somebody within the community. And so I think, Mr. Chairman, even though I know we're running short on money and the time's getting late and the session's almost over, this is a good bill, and I would urge you to vote aye.
Further discussion, Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll be brief. In my other life, I have an opportunity to visit a lot of these schools in our business. My concern is that we're not quite there yet with security, especially in our older schools. And the distance that I'm talking about here, Tensley, Burlington, Clark, 45 minutes, an hour away from any emergency responder. That's frightening. I can walk into Tensley School, K through 12, walk through the front door, there's no buzz in, with a weapon, knock out everybody behind the glass window in the front office and walk down and just take one classroom at a time. Just take the first hall, second hall, or maybe even open gym. I'm right in the school when I walk through that front door. So we're not quite there yet with our security. So I don't know if I can support this completely, but it's a step in the right direction. The SROs, great idea. But on our particular district there in Cali, school district number one, that SRO is on the bubble every year. And it's an agreement between the school district and the sheriff's office. And who's going to pay for the salary? Who's going to? And so these smaller schools, there's not an SRO in those elementary schools. There's not an SRO in those smaller schools. And so we're not quite there yet. I don't know if this is the answer, but I think it's a step in the right direction. Thank you.
Senator Burns.
Chairman, we had this in appropriations today, and I've been listening to the discussion and the going back to just the last comments that were made. Right now, the WeTip program doesn't seem to be working. It makes a call to California. This program would set up an entirely different structure, and you'd be making a call to, I believe, Cheyenne. And then Cheyenne would call there. And I don't know, would call back to Cali or wherever it was where they're having the problem with the school if they felt it was required. And the thing I could never quite understand in all the presentation is why we don't just train the 9/11 operators. That's local in the first place. We already have the infrastructure set up. It just takes, to me, it just may take some time, some training, and some advertising amongst the kids. And it was a question I never really got to ask about that. Because, as I said, the whole thing's in place. The infrastructure's already in place. It just would seem to take more training. I was wondering if one of the proponents of the bill could explain to me why that can't be done, because it seems the reaction time would be quicker.
Senator Coe.
Mr. Chairman, just to answer the question about the WeTips program, it's been in existence for 7 years, and they've had a total of 200 TIFs come in 7 years. To answer the good senator from Sheridan County's concerns, I've been in our dispatch operation in my little town up there where they dispatch fire, ambulance, highway patrol, city police, everybody. They normally only have one dispatcher on duty at a time. You need to have somebody there if the phone rings. And I will say one other thing in extensive testimony in committee and in the Appropriations Committee today. The Attorney General is, very supportive of the bill. He thinks it's a good bill moving in the right direction.
Further discussion. Senator Christensen.
when I was looking at the numbers, and they talked about going from 3 to 5, and then I hear it's 24-7, when I ran a dispatch center, it's 6.7 people to add 24-7 coverage. And so it looks like that's a little bit under the game of what they're actually going to need. 5 won't do it. 3 certainly won't do it. But I didn't see that 3 were actually helping with that. It was just building another couple in there. So the numbers are kind of off if we're talking about these changes in prices for 24-7 coverage and beefing up the folks who are going to answer the phone. And then at the end of the day, it still goes back for me to, we have dispatch centers across the state that have an awful hard time staffing people. Maybe these jobs are going to pay enough more that they'll be able to recruit dispatchers off another location or officers that can handle those calls. But law enforcement generally has a hiring shortage in pretty near every department. I was just talking with Highway Patrol today, and they're in crisis mode. And so when you just create new positions, you're really talking about pulling out of probably existing offices.
Minority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to address a couple of the questions that were still outstanding. One of the senators left, so I'll answer the other question. Why not 911? That was a question that was asked when we discussed it with the committee, and that was considered at one point. But the number of 911 operators, the turnover, and the required training indicates that it would actually cost more money to get them engaged properly, have to look around the state and focus and not have one single easy point. It was proved more difficult. So that was considered during the initial review, but appeared to be more costly and provide a more difficult level of achieving the expertise that was necessary to work with kids in crises as a crisis support line in addition to just being a please hold while we connect you to the police or something along those lines. So the jobs didn't line up as well. It was considered, and it was ruled out for that. The other questioner isn't here, so I'll address his interest offline. And I would just close, Mr. Chairman, by saying that we've been looking at security in schools for 2 years, and we've done very little on it. We bring the best ideas that we have coming out of the task force, coming out of the AG's office, coming out of the Homeland Security. We synthesize these. We put them in legislation. We get good, strong support. And then the price tag scares everyone away. We spend $1.5 billion each year on education, and we're not willing to spend $6 a student on a simple program like this. At the end of the day, we have to go with something. We need to improve security in schools. And to be quite honest, Mr. Chairman, this is the best one we've seen. This is the A game, I think, that's come out of the task force, that security task force the governor put together. Again, we had good testimony on this. The education committee, your education committee, is very convinced that this is something that can make a real difference in the safety and security of our students around the state, all of the students. It is not a perfect solution. There's no question it won't solve all the problems. Nothing will. But prevention is what has been identified as the key. Our law enforcement experts, the best we have in the state, recommend this approach as being the most cost-effective solution for our schools to eliminate many of the tragedies before they happen, before somebody goes active. And that's the concern that was stressed by our Director of Homeland Security. You don't want them to be active. You don't want them to be going to the point of the crime. You want to get to them beforehand if possible. Now that I've got the good senator back, I'll close with answering with regard to the false reporting. That's not specifically mentioned in here. It's an anonymous process. Theoretically, you'd have no problem getting away with an occasional false report based on how it goes forward, but that can happen with 911 as well. Although the anonymity aspect of it, of this, is one of the things that really delineates it from 911, where people aren't willing to call 911 if they have a little bit of a concern because they don't want SWAT to show up for everything. This allows a circumstance where a call can be made to the school. This is a different level, and it's been shown in that state to the south, which it's true we can't count on everything going just the same way, but what we've seen to the south of us is that people have a higher level of comfort with this program than they have with other programs because they know, first of all, that it will be anonymous, and second of all, that action will be taken immediately that is appropriate for the circumstance, not just send the police in right now.
Okay. Any further discussion? Hearing none, you're ready for the question. All those in favor of Senator Coe's motion that when the committee of the whole rise and report, to do so with a due pass recommendation, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
House Bill 144 is passed committee of the whole. Mr. Majority, floor leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, what I'd like to do is take about a 15-20 minute recess to come back at the sound of the gavel and excuse you and your committee to go work on the Joint Conference Committee for the Appropriations, the Supplemental Budget Bill, and have Senator Case come in when we come back and take over for Committee of the Whole. We're going to try to finish the board today.
Thank you. I don't think we have to vote on that, do we, Mr.
No.
All right. Good. See ya.